Okay.
I guess we're ready to introduce you. Have a chair.
Oh, okay. All right.
Evelyn.
Sorry. I was just going to start right in.
No, we'll... Welcome, folks. We hope a few more shows. Tonight, we're going to have an opening song. We don't usually do that. We are going to have an opening song tonight. Starts on this pitch.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Dr. Kurz. Happy birthday to you.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
How many?
Well, I pulled in Star Valley when I was 26 years old, and they just celebrated my 50th year practicing medicine. So I'm 77.
I'm just a kid.
He has a new sign in his office.
Years.
What does it say?
Under old management.
Doc Rhodes gave me
that. Good for him.
His birthday's the same day.
We welcome you here. It's so nice to have you here. We appreciate very much the Wyoming Council for the Humanities and all of the good things they sponsor. And this is part of their program, and we're grateful for that. We're grateful to have Evelyn here. She's a Laramie, Wyoming historian and has done some great research on women. And that's very appropriate. Tonight we're going to hear about Liz Bird, the pioneer in politics in Wyoming for black women. We're delighted to have her here. Evelyn, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to start out and just tell you a little bit about myself. For many years, like over 20, 25, I was the office manager at the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Wyoming, during which time I met 10 to 12 Nobel laureates in physics, had a great career there. But then I thought I needed and wanted to do something more, so I went back to school. My kids were all in school by then, more than in school. Out of school, some of them. And I started taking classes before I left the university, and then I went to school full time, and I got a bachelor's degree in women's studies. And that is women and their history and the things women do are my passion. And after I got my bachelor's degree, which I managed to get through school with a 4.0 and Phi Beta Kappa and one of the top 20 graduates of ANS in 2002, then I went to graduate school and was a graduate teaching assistant in women's studies. And I did my research for my thesis on Japanese American Girl Scouts at Heart Mountain. But I had originally gone hoping to do something on African American women in Wyoming. And about that time, the director of the African American Studies program left and moved to New York. And I had already gotten in with American Studies. And they said, do something else with the African American women. We think this is more appropriate for your thesis. So I graduated with my master's a year ago in July. I teach women's studies at the Albany County campus of LCCC, and I love going around the state talking about all these women I've done research on, one of whom is Liz Bird. You can do the next slide. And so I focused all of my undergraduate and graduate research on women of color, and I've been using oral history methodology to recover the stories of these women, mostly in my home state, known as, of course, the Equality State, but sometimes it's not quite as equal for some as it is others. And until recently, the accomplishments of women were really considered insignificant in the development of the Western frontier of the United States. And according to Glenda Riley, in a book she wrote entitled The Female Frontier, A Comparative View of Women on the Plains and the Prairie, until the mid-1970s, women appeared in the histories of the American West as one-dimensional stereotypes, or not at all. And Riley is referring to historical literature written about the Western frontier prior to the 1970s, portrayed Western development as a male event that included the stereotypical sunbonnet-clad white female, occasionally, and as a minor figure. The female frontier that Riley speaks of course, did include women of color, but little has been written about their accomplishments, and they continue to remain hidden in the history of the Western United States. So there does continue, you can do the next one, to be a need to recover the stories of women and women of color in particular. Now, I'm going to leave this slide up for a little while. It is Liz's family tree, primarily the Roan side of the family, which is her paternal side, her father. Now I'm losing a place here. Okay, so the subject of this presentation is going to be the life and accomplishments of one outstanding African-American woman, Harriet Elizabeth Liz Roan Bird, a fourth-generation Wyoming woman who is the only African-American ever elected to the state legislature of the state of Wyoming. And although she grew up with a double burden of being female and a woman of color, her story is notable also because she overcame numerous barriers to succeed in her personal goals, which included education, politics, career, and a stable family, during a period of time when racism was not only prevalent, but accepted legally and intellectually by many. And I use oral history methodology, and I've interviewed Liz in depth over more than a 3-year period. It's getting closer to 5 years by now because I talk to her still regularly. And she's kept unbelievably extensive documentation of her accomplishments, which most of which she still has in her possession, about 15 notebooks about this thick, filled with clippings and everything she has ever done. So she's allowed me unlimited access to these documents and also her interpretation of them. So her life and accomplishments have been analyzed, and I've been using standpoint epistemology, drawing on the work of Patricia Hill Collins. Now, unless you're a women's studies major, you may not even know what standpoint epistemology is. But what it is, it's a standpoint theory that asserts that knowledge and ways of knowing are related to a specific historical, cultural, and cultural context. And black feminist scholars suggest this for use in an attempt to theorize and analyze events in the relation to the impact of the experiences of women in a specific cultural context. So different social and historical situations result in different experiences and then the theories about those experiences. And black feminist standpoint theory gives a voice to African-American women whose minds and talents have been suppressed by the pots and kettles symbolic of black women's subordination. And although black women historians, writers, and social scientists have long existed, the exclusion of African-American women in the historical canon has been reinforced by a continued negative image of African-American women that continues to permeate the popular culture and public policy. And the life of black feminist theory is used as a research strategy, and it advances this theoretical perspective that's useful in the analysis of lives of African-American women, and Liz Bird in particular, as the outsider within. And the outsider within perspective is that of an individual who is outside the dominant culture and yet has access to an intimate knowledge of the workings of that culture. So understanding the contradictions and ideologies of the dominant culture provides a different vision of oppression and allows a much greater ability to work within the system and to succeed. So analysis from this perspective provides a clearer understanding of the lives of women of color. Now, I don't know if you've been able to see this well enough to look, but it's Liz Bird's family tree beginning with, and I'll digress a little bit if you don't mind. The woman from Martinique gave birth to Charles Roan, who was Liz's grandfather. And the woman from Martinique is quite interesting. Liz said, "We don't really think she was a slave. We think that she worked for the Roan family in Martinique. And when Mr. Roan, not any first name, came to the United States on some kind of work, she came with him. And she had two children, with him. But he was a government worker for the United States government in some way, and at some point he was stationed in Laramie, whatever it was he did, and his two boys and his and the woman from Martinique's sons stayed in Laramie when they moved on to wherever they went next. And the brother moved back to Washington, D.C., and Charlie Roan stayed in Laramie and became a cowboy and married Liz's grandmother and had her father. So I think it's a real interesting story how they got to Laramie, and they have been longtime residents. Okay, I guess we could go on to the next slide. And this is Liz's family, and I'm going to be talking about the importance of family to someone like Liz Bird, and so I thought this was an appropriate picture. The couple in the center, the little short woman and the man behind her, that's her parents, and it's their 50th wedding anniversary, and the first gentleman and woman are Liz and her husband, Jim. And so a difference that this kind of analysis brings to light is that of self-definition. And self-definition in the African-American community is distinct from many other cultures because it is not defined by autonomy, as are many of us. You have to grow up and become self-independent and autonomous. The self-definition for African-Americans is not defined by increased autonomy and separation from others. Instead, it is found in the context of family and community. And it's described by Polly Marshall in Black Feminist Thought as the ability to recognize one's continuity within the larger community. So rather than defining oneself in opposition to others, there's a connectedness within the African-American community. That the action of one individual is seen as representing the entire community. So self-definition has a much deeper connection to others. And the importance of family and community in the life of Liz Bird is explored in this presentation. And as I said, her life is analyzed not only in the context of Black feminist theory, but also African American self-definition and the usefulness of African American women's placement as the outsider within. Liz's grandparents' and parents' lives as African Americans in mostly white communities gave them very strong ties within both the white community in Laramie, Wyoming, where they started out, and later a larger black and white community in Cheyenne. And this legacy gave Liz the advantage of understanding the white community and the black community and a greater ability to reach her personal goals as an African-American woman coming of age in the western United States in the 1940s.
Which one is Liz up there?
The second woman.
Right next to her.
This one right here. And that's her husband, Jim. So in 1903, if you can think back to the family tree, Liz's grandparents, Charlie Roan and Elizabeth Duff Roan, became the proud parents of Robert Buck Roan, Liz's father. And he was the first African-American child born in Albany County. If you don't mind me digressing, I would tell you about her grandmother, Elizabeth Duff Roan, because it's another real interesting story. And later on, I'll mention about her twin brother, her grandmother's twin brother was murdered, and her mother had died. So the father brought a mean stepmother in. Actually, it was an aunt, but she was mean. So this Elizabeth Duff was determined she was going to get, she thought she, herself and her twin brother, away. And she answered an ad in a newspaper for a housekeeper. And on the strength of her ability as a 12-year-old girl to write well, can't think of his name, Knight, the oldest Dr. Knight, hired her without ever having seen her and gave her a train ticket to come to Laramie. She arrived and she's a little girl. She couldn't be a housekeeper, but she stayed. And she helped them with the kids. She went out on digs with them. And then eventually she grew up, and I think Dr. Knight introduced her to Charlie Roan, and they got married. So it's interesting how they got to Laramie. So these two had Liz's father, Buck Roan. And he was called Buck all of his life because he was so enamored with the Wyoming football team, and there was a football player named Buck, and he was over there with them all the time, so the people began to call him Little Buck. So he had that name all of his life. And he was, as I said, the first African-American child born in Albany County. And then he married Sudie, and they had Liz. And this is Liz as a little girl with her younger brother, Robert. And I don't have a picture of her second brother as an infant. But she was born in the home of her grandparents, which they called the Big House, on O'Neill Street in Cheyenne in April of 1926. So she turned 80 years old this past April. And the Big House was the birthplace of all of Liz's siblings, all of their own children. There were three of them, another son. And they were a part of a small African population in Cheyenne. And she grew up during the Depression in a state, I think you'll agree with me, that where national trends are less sharply felt. And racism had not subsided in the United States at that time, of course. And black men were routinely lynched without any consequence up until the 50s. The last one I know of was Emmett Till, and that was in the mid-50s. And he was another little 12-year-old boy. And the maternal side of the family that I just told you about suffered the death of a child. And it probably was due to racism, but this 12-year-old twin of her grandmother was found dead in a field. Nobody knew what happened to him. Nobody investigated it. And the way Liz put it, she said, it's just how it was in those days. A young black boy would turn up dead and no one cared or did anything about it. So in Cheyenne, racism was still certainly accepted, and black people were mostly just left alone and they were invisible people. However, the Roan family were really not a family that wanted to stay to themselves or be left alone. They were going to be part of the community. First, her grandparents, followed by her parents, were very well known in both the white and black communities. So Liz was born with this outsider within legacy that I've talked about because of the previous relationships built by her parents and grandparents. So she came into this world believing she could and would accomplish whatever she set out to do. Growing up in the almost all-white city of Cheyenne, Wyoming, made her definitely an outsider by definition, and the strength and stability of her immediate family was important to Liz in developing the self-definition she would need to succeed. As you can see, Liz and her siblings, well, were not exactly the kind that weren't well known. They were raised in a middle class family that fits the description given by William A. Maraskin in his book Middle Class Blacks in a White Society. And he said to be a middle class black family, they had valued hard work, education, striving to success, to excel. And he also said that it really didn't matter what kind of a job. There was not prestige in anything other than having a job, working hard, and doing a good job, because at that time there were only so many occupations any black people could actually get work in. And I think this could be described also as unconscious resistance to negative images that were so prevalent of African Americans during this time period. And African Americans in Wyoming were pretty few in numbers and mostly invisible. And I say this mostly invisible. Have any of you ever heard of Todd Gunther? He did a master's thesis in history in the late 70s, and it was on African American homesteaders in Wyoming. Then a year or so ago, he came to Laramie and gave a talk that he called Let Them Eat Chicken. And I'm not sure why that was the title, but it was some more information about African-American homesteaders. And what he said that really stuck, what?
Probably traces back to Catherine, to France.
Oh, let them eat cake?
Let them eat bread.
Yeah, probably.
Let them eat cake.
Yeah, that could be. Well, anyway, in this talk, he said he asked his grandfather, who had homesteaded, and he knew there were a number of African-American homesteaders in that area. And he said, no, never seen any, didn't know them, there were not any there. So he said to his grandfather, they were literally invisible. But as you can see from this, Liz and her two younger brothers were far from invisible. In fact, Liz has missed one pancake breakfast during frontier days in all of her life since she was old enough to be there, and that was she had some surgery one summer and wasn't able to get back to it. And they excelled in everything they did in school. The boys were top athletes. Her youngest brother played professional basketball for the New York Knickerbockers, and they were well known and admired in the community at large, and they didn't really conform to the role as exemplified by this involvement in the community, both black and white. And they lived in a white neighborhood. And in fact, they bought this home in the white neighborhood, and it had a couple of vacant lots where all the kids in the neighborhood played. Pretty soon, since hers were the only African-American children, there was some fussing and something going on, not treating them so well. So Sudi and Buck just bought the vacant lots. And they said, everybody can play on the vacant lots as long as everyone treats everyone else with respect and we don't have any fussing or fighting. So I think this is another example of unconscious resistance to racism. And they also were prominent members of their church. Father sang in the choir, and at one time he was the state president of the, or the president of the State Musicians Union. And they were well-known members of the Democratic Party. And during her early years, her life was, do the next one, quite sheltered, and she didn't really experience racism. However, upon graduation from Cheyenne High School, and she began to think about going to college, and of course, racism and racial discrimination was prevalent all over the United States at that time. But she was admitted to the University of Wyoming, and that was where she wanted to go to school. They had that deep connection to the University of Wyoming. However, they telephoned the family and said, Elizabeth cannot live in the residence halls on campus because she's an African American. So they said, well, she's not going to go to school there in that case. So she applied to Greeley State Teachers College. Same thing, couldn't live on campus. So they didn't know what they were going to do. And Liz said it was more important for her parents that the two boys got into good schools. So they weren't really worrying that much about her. Because she said that's, you know, how it was at that time, but she was. So what Liz did was put on a little piece of paper every state in the United States, taking out, of course, Wyoming and Colorado, put them in a mason jar, shook them up, pulled one out, and it was the state of West Virginia. So she did research on what institutions were available, and there were three that she was interested in. Two were all black universities, and one was not a black university, which was the University of West Virginia, and they would not admit blacks. Another one was Bluefield State, and her father didn't like the academic credentials of that one. So that left West Virginia State College. So that's where she went, left all by herself, went on the train all the way across the United States to West Virginia, got off the train, didn't see anything that looked like a university, didn't even look like a town. So she asked the station agent, and he said, oh, no, the college is several miles from here. So showing this strong sense of self, Liz went to the payphone and telephoned the president of the university. He got himself and his wife and his children in the car, came and picked her up, and she was a few days too early. The residence halls weren't open, so she lived with them until the dorms opened. That, I thought that was just incredible that she would do that, and it was wonderful. It would have had to be in the early 40s. 44. It was before the war started, I think. So it was maybe.
She graduated
in 40. She graduated, yeah. 40. Okay, so this was 40, if she graduated in 44. And she remembers this, her time at that college, as the most rewarding of her life. She has a big quilt that was made, or blanket, with all of the outstanding graduates, and they had a big celebration one year, and she was one of their outstanding graduates. And of course, at this time, the war was going on, the face of Cheyenne, Wyoming was changing, and the military base, Fort Francis E. Warren, had expanded greatly, and many of the airmen stationed there were African American. And of course, racism certainly did still exist. The black community had to develop their own USO because the African American boys weren't allowed in the official USO. Of course, at this time, Liz was away at university, but her parents and grandparents were very active in setting up the black USO. So, the summer after her sophomore year, Liz returned, and that summer she met a young man, and her parents, as it turned out later, knew him from the USO. But the way she met him is a very interesting story. Her cousin had gotten married during the year, and she got back that summer, and she invited Liz to come out where she lived on the base and meet her husband. So she went out for dinner, and they were ready to sit down for dinner, and her cousin said, "Oh, we need some soda to have with dinner." And Liz said, "Well, I'll just run over to the PX and get it." So she over there, picked it up. She's in line, realizes, "I don't have any authorization to buy something from a PX." But she was very embarrassed. She didn't want to take her purchase back. She didn't know what to do. So she said, "I kind of looked around, and there was this one guy that didn't look too bad. So I went over and explained my situation to him, and he said, well, sure, he'd help me out." So he did, and they were starting to leave, and she was trying to get this her purchase, pay him, and it was a six-pack of Pepsi, and he put it under his arm, and he said, "I'm going wherever this Pepsi's going." So he came with her to her cousin's, and turned out he knew her cousin's husband, so they dated that entire summer. Then Liz went back to school, and she only heard from him once that entire year. And he sent her a Valentine, and it just said, "I'm coming to marry you someday." So she returned after her junior year, got back to Cheyenne, and found out he wasn't even there. He had been reassigned and was now in New Jersey. So she said after about 2 weeks after she'd gotten home for the summer, she got a telegram from him. You know what it said? "I'm coming to marry you." And she said, "I took that statement as Jim Bird was telling me I was going to marry him, not asking, and I was not at all sure I wanted to marry him." She said, however, after she was given a good talking to by the priest at St. Mary's Church, where Jim Bird was a parishioner, and her parents knew him, and they liked him, and they gave her a talking to, and so she agreed to marry Jim. And so they married. Oh, you can go to the next one. I think that's the picture of, sort of a celebration. And so she returned to college. He returned to New Jersey to the military, and as she graduated that spring, and he was discharged, and they went back to Cheyenne to make their home, where Jim began his long career in law enforcement, and Liz began her long struggle to gain employment in education, her chosen field. And it would take her 10 years to be hired as a teacher in the Laramie County school system. But she continued to use her outsider within heritage and this strong sense of self-definition and never gave up her goal. She did get a job on the base in warehousing and soon was asked to be a teacher and teaching the airmen. But she wanted to be an elementary school teacher in Cheyenne, Wyoming, her home. So she applied for teaching positions every year. Liz said, every time I applied, the administrator in charge would just tell me politely, "Liz, we just don't hire colored women." Finally, she decided she needed to take it a step higher. So she started trying to get an appointment with the state superintendent of schools. Kept being rebuffed, could never get in. Finally, she did and got basically the same response. The superintendent of schools was Velma Linford, and for a long time, Liz wouldn't let me use her name.
She came from here.
Did she? She grew up here?
Yeah.
Because I knew her when she was a teacher at Laramie High School, too. So Velma Linford said, "It's just not our policy to hire colored women." And Liz emphasized to me, she said, "I had a baccalaureate degree, and most of the school teachers they were hiring at that time had teaching certificates. And I felt I was definitely as well qualified, if not more, to teach the children of Cheyenne." So with this in mind, she started trying to get an appointment with the governor to talk to him about it. But he was always busy, and she never could seem to get an appointment with him. However, one morning, as she was walking out of the governor's secretary's office for what turned out to be the final time, he was coming into his office just then, and he knew Liz. "Well, Liz, what are you doing here? Come on into my office and have a cup of coffee." So she went in and told him that she was trying to get a job and couldn't get hired, and that apparently there was a policy in the school system of this state that not to hire African-American women. And he said, "Well, there is no policy such as that, and I'll look into the matter." So that fall, she was teaching in Cheyenne. and she taught until retirement. So she, and she quickly became well-known and a respected teacher, and she taught until she retired. You can go on to the next.
Who is the governor?
J.J.
Yeah, Hickey. Joe Hickey. So it would seem now Liz had a very full life. She had her much sought-after teaching career. She was a very esteemed teacher, and she and her husband, in fact, right after this article, it was published in Annals, I ran into somebody that had her for a teacher. And they said, oh man, we were scared to death of her. She really made us learn, you know. Okay, so she had this. She and her husband had their family, their three children, and he was by this time chief of the Cheyenne Police Department, but then tragedy struck the family. Her younger, adored brother, Robert, who was a prominent Colorado attorney and a rising star in the Colorado State Legislature, died. And it was very tragic. He slipped on the ice, fell, broke his leg, which seemed like a real minor incident. And he went ahead right after a few days and flew to Albuquerque, New Mexico to take a deposition and got blood clots and died. But the family rallied around and decided, well, Liz is just going to have to fulfill the family political ambitions that seemed to have died with Robert. So Liz ran for the position of state representative representing Laramie County, first African American to run for the state legislature since statehood. There was an African American in the territorial legislature, a man. And at that time, I'm sure you all know this, candidates were all at large positions. There weren't the precincts there are now. So Liz said, in my very first time to run for office, I got the second highest number of votes in the county. And she became known as the People's Legislator. And she was first elected in 1980. And at the time of her election, there were 14 women, including Liz, out of the 90 seats in both houses of the state and the Senate. This is Liz's official political picture that she always uses. And when I discussed this with her, her years in the legislature, she said there was an atmosphere in the state house that was hostile to women, and to me in particular, because I was a black woman. This racial and sexist hostility toward women crossed party lines and was found primarily among the more conservative white men. She said, for example, both houses of the state legislature frowned upon the implementation of a woman's caucus for either party. And to this day, a woman's caucus does not exist in the Wyoming state legislature. In addition, it was rare at that time for a woman to have a committee chairmanship. And Byrd found that a lot of her efforts to present and pass bills were hampered by the fact that a significant number of her female colleagues refused to support her bills. Byrd said, these women refused because they were afraid of losing a good committee assignment by supporting bills I sponsored. I could understand their reluctance, but it was disappointing. And you can tell from that comment, she never takes anything really personal as far as racial issues or anything like that. And in addition, Liz said, many of the bills I sponsored were considered special, and that is not relating to the major economic areas of the state, ranching or mineral interests, for example. She sponsored bills that were often human rights issues, which were unpopular with these same more conservative white males who were in power at the time, because the bills weren't directed toward economic interests, but human interests. But Liz never ever even considered giving up her battle for human rights and special issues. And her strong sense of self was refined and strengthened by her growing outsider within knowledge through her years of successfully pushing the envelope of what was considered an appropriate role for an African American woman. And throughout her tenure in the state legislature, she often took on causes that weren't really popular and sometimes difficult to pass. And one, she never ever thought that it would be difficult to pass. She was a member of the Transportation Committee, and it was the Child Restraint Bill. And on the surface, it seemed like it would have just sailed right through. After all, Liz said, it was a safety issue involving children, and by 1985, 49 states, with Tennessee being first in 1977, had passed child restraint bills. This is car seats, is what we're talking about here. However, she found it took her a couple of years to get this bill passed, and when it finally became a law, it was only after many attachments had been added. And what Liz said was, State of Wyoming just doesn't like to feel that the federal government is telling the state to do something, and that was how they viewed this child restraint law. And then two of the bills she sponsored for passage brought her national recognition. And the first that I'm going to talk about, you might think is of little importance, but I think with the big picture, it is pretty significant. Liz said, I was teaching second grade at Deming Elementary School in 1985. And because I was in the state legislature, my students questioned where I was and what I was doing when I wasn't in class and there was a substitute. So she explained her absence by giving her students a little lesson on how a bill becomes a law. And they were really interested. So Bird told them she'd try to find something that they could propose and that she would sponsor it in the legislature. So interestingly enough, they soon had a section on mammals, and her students were quite interested in it and wanted to know, what's the Wyoming mammal? So after investigation, they realized and found out Wyoming didn't have one at the time. And most other states did have a designated state mammal. So the second graders began this project. They worked very hard on it, thinking about what mammal would be good to sponsor and would be appropriate. And they came up with a couple. There was the bison buffalo, which I guess is a little segment of buffalo, because it definitely is the bison buffalo. And the other was the antelope. So they had campaigns, and they thought about it and had a hotly contested vote, but the bison buffalo won out. So they began now to be ready to write the bill. With the help of their teacher and someone else from the state legislature helped them, proposing this bill be presented designating this state mammal. And it was House Bill 30, sponsored by Liz Bird and co-sponsored by Senator Jack Pugh. House Bill 30 was killed in the Senate. A new bill, Senate File 0275, once again sponsored by Bird and Pugh, was submitted. Liz is quoted in the Wyoming Educator in January 1985 as saying, I would like everyone to get involved, and I'm asking that students across the state write their local legislators, urging them to vote for the bill. The project caught the public attention, and Liz Bird and her second graders, who probably by now were third graders, were featured in news media across the state and the nation. And it became a struggle when one of her fellow legislators, might have been somebody from around up here, I have it, might say in there, in the article, I don't remember. He anyway proposed a competing designation, and it was the pronghorn antelope, but he also had a state fish, which was maybe the cutthroat trout and something else. But Bird's students appeared before the legislature speaking in favor of their bill, and the public interest was growing hotly with this. Many letters written by school children throughout to their state legislators asking for support, and she said they had the support of the governor at that time, Ed Hirschler. So it resulted in passage of the bill originated by second graders at Deming School. The buffalo became the state mammal in 1987. So it took them 2 years. So was this important work? I think it was. A class of young students learned firsthand about government, how it works, writing their own bill, getting it proposed by their teacher, attending legislative sessions to testify in favor of their bill, and seeing it eventually passed by both houses of the Wyoming Senate. And this is just one more example of her tenacity and her strong identity. She believed that second graders' choice of a state mammal was important enough of an issue to take it to the state legislature and fight for passage against strong opposition. And of course, we all know the most important bill, I assume, in her, she feels it is. And she worked relentlessly on it for about 9 years. And that was ratification of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday by the state of Wyoming. And it was one of her most difficult accomplishments. And it took her 9 years from her first introduction of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday until it was finally ratified, and the 9 years were marked by strife and animosity throughout the state. Wyoming newspapers were filled with letters pro and con from the public and from Byrd's fellow legislators. And even one of her fellow teachers in the same school spoke out against her publicly, quoted in the Cheyenne Tribune. He said, "Our Wyoming Senate agreed to consider the King holiday bill on Monday, held committee hearings Tuesday morning, passed the bill out to the floor for hearing and vote. Who said the wheels of government grind so slowly? All this to honor a man who is a seditionist, hypocrite, apostate, and borderline anarchist." And his comments are a little interesting, since it had taken 9 years and never even got to the floor most of the time when it was finally voted on. It hadn't really been such a short time. But even more frightening to me was the story she told about being confronted in the State House by an Aryan Nation minister who came specifically to Wyoming to confront her about sponsoring this bill. But she wasn't intimidated by him and never wavered in her goal to get ratification of the bill. And Wyoming was the 44th state to ratify the, I guess we could go on to the next one. Look at that one for a while. Wyoming was the 44th state to ratify the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, and in order to have to do this, she had to agree that the name would be Martin Luther King Jr. Equality Day, which that's what we know it as today. And Liz was personally recognized for her efforts on behalf of the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Martin Luther King Jr., during a meeting personally with his now deceased widow, Coretta Scott King. So Byrd, along with most of the women, especially the ones who were members of the Democratic Party, lost their bids for re-election when the state changed from the at-large system to counties being divided into precincts. And I know in Albany County, Sheila Arnold was one of our legislators that lost election, and she was a female Democrat. So Elizabeth Harriet Liz Roan Byrd has represented the state of Wyoming not only in the legislature, but on the national level in several organizations, such as the National Education Association and the Democratic Party. And in a recent conversation with Liz and Jim, just prior to Jim's death, he made the following comment. He said those organizations were using Liz. They needed minority representation to make them look good. I asked Liz if she agreed with that comment. And she said, well, that yes, they did use me, but I used them too. Because of my minority status, I was able to serve on important committees at the national level in both organizations. So she has such a strong sense of self and who she is, and she takes what she gets and makes the very best of it. And I think it's using her outsider within knowledge that's always been a part of her life. And as I said previously, she doesn't really acknowledge any discrimination. Jim was a little more, he noted some of the things, especially things said or done to Liz, which would come right off of her shoulders, but it bothered him a little more. I have a friend who worked in the legislature as a clerk during the time she was a legislator, and she said she looked like a queen when she entered that room and came walking down the aisle. Okay, and go to the last one. So the life of Liz Byrd, I believe, emphasizes the necessity to recover oral histories of other women of color who have so enriched the culture of the state of Wyoming. And Liz Byrd and her family are just one example that provides data that African American women have and continue to contribute to the diversity of the culture of the Western United States, building a legacy of excellence. Thanks for having me, and if anybody has any questions, I'd love to answer them. Talk about Liz a little more. Thank you.
Where's Liz now?
She lives in Cheyenne on Antelope Street, something like that. Yeah. It's a new addition, kind of new. It's right over by the governor's mansion. And she goes to California. They have a home out there that she goes for about a month. She belongs to the Retired Teachers Association in Cheyenne. She's had me over once to go with her to lunch at that. And she's still real active in things over there.
Do her children live in Wyoming?
Yes, all but one. Her daughter, Linda, lives in Cheyenne and is the manager of Rodell's Pharmacy. And then I think it's her son, his name is Jim, is a dentist in Sheridan at the state hospital. And he is a Air Force Reserve, and he's just spent a year in Iraq and got back a day before his father died. And then the other son, whose name I don't remember, I guess it's on that family tree, and I've never met or seen him, but he is a has a computer company of some kind and lives in the Midwest someplace. She has a couple of grandsons that are Linda's sons that spend a lot of time with her and do things with her. When I did this talk at the Old West Museum, Liz and her daughter and one of the grandsons came. That was fun. It was interesting. Good to have her there. Yes?
How many years did she actually serve in the
I think it was 12.
Consecutive?
Yeah. Representative and then in the Senate. She did both, yeah.
You've been close to her. Is there any racism in her?
I don't think so. I do not think so, because she just, Jim told another story one time, and he said who the person was, and I don't remember, but they were in a group at some kind of a function for legislators and their spouses, just, you know, people standing around talking like at a cocktail party or something, and some man said the N-word in Liz's presence, and she probably didn't even hear it, but he took this man aside and said something to him about it. And a little short while later, he wrote her a letter of apology. It's sort of like, I guess, swearing in front of somebody it was to them. And he also talked about restaurants that wouldn't let them in.
Democrats are pretty rare in Star Valley.
Well, yeah, I'm sure. Well, they are in the state of Wyoming.
To be a Democrat and to be covered would be outstanding.
Oh, it would be, yeah, be pretty interesting, yeah. Yes, absolutely. You'd be a real rare bird. Yeah. Yes, she's, yeah, quite a woman. So I thank you so much for, yes, go ahead.
I'm really surprised there hasn't been a tie-in to the railroad because of the number of blacks that were hired by the railroad and reporters in that era of time, because my family lived in Atlanta.
Right. Yes, he did. He was a machinist. And I think that he was in Cheyenne. And there, the whole family is buried in Blue Hill Cemetery. I don't think Jim is now, but the boys are. Because they had Buck, and then they had they had Buck first, and then they had another son named Ottaway. And he was injured, like fell and hit his head and died. So they bought the big family plot and Mary and Ottaway and her parents, her grandparents are all buried there.
So the families lived in Cheyenne their adult lives, but they were from Laramie,
yeah,
and they're buried in Laramie.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting. And I don't think, she probably died by now, but Buck Rome's youngest sister Daisy was alive 2 years ago.
That's the cemetery right next to the university.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They have a real big headstone for the family. Quite thin. Very bright.
They were all impressive, like she was, as far as when they were out in public, they part?
I don't know them, but I would assume so, because Tommy was recruited to be to play with the New York Knickerbockers, and she said he hated it. After one season, he refused to sign another contract. She said, of course, that was before they made so much money. And then he went back to school and got a master's degree and was a coach and a teacher, and then worked for some philanthropic organization giving out grants. He was decided on who got the grants, and he had Liz on the committee for a while. And then, of course, Robert, the boys both went to DU, and they both played basketball at DU, and Robert went to law school there, and was an attorney and a legislator. died.
Dean of St. Denver University. We're from Star Valley. We don't have too much technology.
As you can see. I knew Buck.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, Diana. I never, his diction in English, his demeanor was always good.
Yeah.
You know, you could just see quality in him.
Well, you know, I just remembered something that Liz told about when I gave this talk in Cheyenne. Buck was working on a ranch. And whoever this rancher was, and she said he never wanted his name known, and she wouldn't tell him. He paid for them to move to Cheyenne and come to school for Buck's fee. So, yeah, education was always very important. And it was the same thing with Liz's grandmother, Elizabeth, that he married. They both were, you know, considered.
Pretend you didn't hear it.
You know, you've got to go.
Bye.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks for presenting.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ellen, very much.
Oh. Thank you very much for having me. Now I can get up tomorrow morning and make that short drive home.
Well, it used to be 10 hours when we went to school there.
Really?
Yes.
You get there by the time the ball game.
I don't go to our pay
attention. I was there last night.
I think the money that goes to the ball game. That was the ticket box.
How much? 27.
Are you going down tomorrow?
No, I will actually.
Were you in the nosebleed section for $27?
No, I had good seats.